Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human.
Hey Clayton, how's it going today?
Hey Benny, it's going pretty sweet. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Great, because on today's podcast, we have the first person that I ever shared a room with on an IQ getaway as a guest. And that's very exciting for me.
Wow, yeah.
So
it's a good time.
So my longtime friend, and I've never really worked directly with him, but just pal, Dave Emmett is your guest on the podcast today.
You know, what's really neat is that I don't know Dave at all. I know who he is, but I've never sat down and had a conversation with him. But what was intriguing about this particular conversation was that he and I both have the experience of working at startups in our group of companies, but 20 years apart. So I was doing what he's been doing for the last few years. I was doing that 20 years ago. There's some really interesting things that emerge in this conversation. Like, we get to talk about the challenge of the startup and what seems from outside the chaos of that, but inside it is such a wonderful kind of intimate thing. It's a relationship between you and your colleagues and your skills and what the client problems are. And then as the company grows, the challenges change in scale. But they're actually very similar challenges, and the rewards are very similar, which is the ability to solve problems for clients with people that you actually really enjoy solving problems with. And that's where all this fuel comes from. It's quite fascinating, and it was a conversation that really energized me because it took me back in time. It was like time travel for me, remembering, oh yeah, that's how energetic that was. That's what was wonderful about that. And I just noticed in the conversation, I just have moment after moment after moment of that while we're talking.
To add some fuel to the fire that you're talking about, and actually to, you know, build on what you're saying, I've always really wanted Dave to do the podcast. I was happy when he finally found the time to do it, because the interesting thing about Dave is Dave is probably one of the most considerate and tactful people that I know. And I think that really comes through in the conversation that you two have. And the podcast is more than, well, this one especially, is more than just Clayton being a host and asking our guests some questions. It really is a conversation. And it's a real treat because I know Dave pretty well and I know you pretty well, but this was an opportunity where I got to know both of you even better through the conversation that you had.
Yeah, it was a back and forth, much, much more of that than just me interviewing somebody. Very different. And it comes through in the conversation. I'm glad you noticed that and enjoyed it.
Well, let's take a listen to the conversation now.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Hey there, welcome to the podcast. Unpacking Chrysalis, the Art of Being Human, is a project that we spun up to build community around talking with some of the people that we work with. Today, I'm chatting with Dave Emmett, who's in the world city of Vancouver, one of my favorite places to spend time. Dave, welcome to the pod. I'm really glad that you were able to spend some time with us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here, Clayton.
Oh, that's, yeah, well, you were on the list. People we were trying to chat with, and so Benny was pretty excited for sure to have you.
It's a very long list, I assume.
Yeah. Well, the project is actually called Record 100 Podcasts because I saw Mr. Beast, if you're not familiar with him, Google him. Well, he's extraordinary. And somebody asked him, how do you make a good YouTube video? This is a guy who's, you know, got a $10 billion business making, you know, YouTube videos essentially and other things. But a $10 billion business. And he said, well, you know, before you can make a good YouTube video, you have to make 100. And I was like, oh, that's neat. So that's why this project actually in my calendar is called Record 100 Podcasts. I think we're at like 15, 16. So,
okay, you're so early. Your expectations are that this is not good.
Right. Well, this is a developmental interview. Yeah, for me. Okay, well, you're going to be great. I'm developing.
Okay.
All right. Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
We'll see how it goes. Hey, so you and I, we met to find a path for our conversation recently. And, you know, being a man of many interests, we had a few options. But in the end, we landed on chatting about the experience of working at a startup. So is that still something you'd like to spend our time chatting about today, or has something else emerged from your worldview that we should focus on?
No, I think that sounds great. I'm excited to talk about it. I think, I think it's cool for us to spend some time, and I think there's like both of us have stuff to say about it, which is going to be interesting.
Yeah, I think it is fascinating when that topic emerged. Was I was at Icumetrix when it was a startup. I'm employee number 8, and then you went to Cova as it spun up in the early days. So we're both pretty early into the door on these companies. So I think there's a fascinating chat to be had. So let's just dive in. As I was saying, you and I have this experience 20 years apart, and when I think about what I'm curious about with your experience at Cova is, how is it that you came to decide to spend your time or a bit of your time over there in terms of your career?
You know, it's kind of funny because my history at Icumetrix, I'm probably going to refer to it as Icumetrix,
Yeah, that's what it is.
was I joined in, I guess, 2011, I think. And I worked at IQ for about a year and a half to 2 years. And then I left to go work for a startup. Because I really had this idea in my head that I wanted to be part of a company that, kind of like, I don't know, sort of in on the ground floor, but like,
Yeah.
work on something that was just starting, that was like, it was nothing. There was a few people. It was like, I
Yeah.
really was enamored with that idea of like working for that type of company. And Icumetrix wasn't really that type of company, right? Like it
No.
was when you started, when you were
Yeah.
there, but like it, by that point, IQ was not that company. So I went off and I worked for a startup, and honestly, like it didn't quite work out. And I went to work for a different startup, and it didn't quite work out. And then we were having a baby. My son is 8 years old now. And I think I was just sort of at this point where I was like, you know what? I could just like not do that for a while and like come back to this place that like I had a really great experience working at. I really enjoyed all the people I was with. Like I can just sort of chill for a bit and
Yeah.
like just sort of take it easy, contribute something, but like I don't have to do this
Course.
thing anymore.
The hustle of a
The
startup.
hustle.
Yeah.
And within like 3 or 4 months of being back at IQ, I was into this startup idea. It
Yeah.
was like, okay, no, now we're doing this thing. And the whole thing, like, and we really did it. And it was like, a big.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think there's something really funny for me of like, I kind of, it's like I gave up on that, but like, I sort of like decided I was going to sort of put it on the back burner for a little while. And as
Yeah.
soon as I did that, it like happened,
Yeah.
the thing I kind of wanted.
Oh,
So
that's interesting.
that
Yeah.
was interesting. But I mean, it wasn't really like a big conscious choice. I had rejoined Icumetrix. I was working on this project that was sort of had been going on for a while, this sort of like, let's build a tablet point of sale idea.
Yeah.
And we didn't really know what it was going to be. It was just sort of like, we got to find who it's going to be for. And I've told this story at like our Christmas party and stuff like that. So I'll share it
Okay.
to you, which was that I was in the kitchen one day, and CK, so founder, CEO of Icumetrix, came in and asked me, it's like, Dave, how much do you know about marijuana? I was like, like
Trick question.
a totally socially acceptable amount. And I guess it's like that was the right answer, because then I started getting involved in this like discussion about, oh, we're gonna focus on the cannabis industry, and
Yeah.
we hired Gary. It all just sort of like started happening. But I mean, at that stage, it was not like we were not a startup. We were just a team within Icumetrix, right? We were just working on a project effectively. It was like,
Yeah.
okay, we're gonna do this thing and we're learning some stuff, and it was really fun, but it also, I mean, it felt real, but it also wasn't quite real yet.
Yeah,
We
it's a
didn't
bit
have
of a
any
bubble, right?
customers,
Like
we didn't have
you're wrapped up in a bit of a protection too, because you're
totally.
within the Chrysalis ecosystem, which
We're not
is the
having
whole.
conversations about revenue. We're not having
Yeah.
conversations about, operational costs. We're not having, churn
Yeah.
discussions. We're just having,
Yeah.
hey, this would be great. Let's go
Yeah.
do this. Let's figure it out.
How do we build this
And
business? And how do we leverage the relationships that we already have within this ecosystem? Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like that, I mean, that it's kind of like, it just sort of started, I don't want to say snowballing, but like, you know, it's just like, it started building each piece built on the other, right? Yeah. There's not like a moment where it was, oh, I have to decide to be part of this or be part of something else. You just sort of keep on, it's inertia, right? Like you're just doing the next thing that was like kind of came after the last one.
Yeah. What sort of work do you do over there at Kova?
So now I'm the director of product. Mm. And so what that means is I'm effectively in a role of helping us choose what the right things to build for our customers are. So, you know, we're talking to our customers, we're understanding what's going on with the business, we're deciding like, hey, what are these like seven things that everyone agrees are the best things to possibly do? Which one or two are we going to do? Because we can't possibly do all of them. And, you know, how do we think through that? And how do we sort of make these trade-offs? And it's a lot of that. And my role has shifted because in the early days, I was doing that same type of work, but more on a specific team. And now I work like there's a team of product managers and I help oversee the team. So
right. And when you were a little kid, that's what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Yes. Yes. If you ask my parents, they would say when Dave was a child, he dreamed of being a product manager for a cannabis retail point of sale system.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he foresaw that the system would be illegal.
You're right.
And that this career path that did not exist would be the right choice.
Yeah. It's just so obvious.
No, I didn't. I never really had like a childhood dream of a job.
That makes sense, actually.
I just did stuff.
What a blessing. I always feel bad for kids when they get asked, what do you want to be when you grow up, and they realize I'm supposed to be something when I grow up. I'm seven, what are you talking about? And then all of a sudden they have to construct this thing. I just feel like in retrospect it's just this unfair thing that we do to kids that I am not going to do to, you know, children in my life.
Yeah, I try not to ask my kids that question.
No.
I think it's because it creates the idea of like, oh, you're supposed to pick a thing.
A thing.
And the reality is even like by the time I was in school, certainly by the time they're, you know, getting older and choosing careers and jobs, like there's not going to be a one thing. You're going to do a million things. Yeah. And most of the jobs that they'll do probably don't exist yet.
Exactly. They just don't. I mean, look at the stuff that we're doing. These things didn't exist when we were kids. You know, they didn't exist 20 years ago.
Did kids dream of being a prompt engineer for, you know, AI? Did they dream of being a TikTok like choreographer? You know, these things don't make any sense, but like they're jobs that people, you know, do. Dream of being a YouTube content creator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't believe how rapidly this prompt engineer meme, and then it's just how fast it emerged and became like kind of the way we describe this emergent job thing, a prompt engineer. What the hell is that 2 years ago? And now it's like, you better be pretty good.
Now there's probably someone working for, you know, Google and stuff that's making pretty good money just prompting.
Yeah, I mean, even in the day-to-day work world, the people that are better at prompting the AIs are incrementally getting ahead. They just are. There's just no way to not believe that's true. I mean, I see it all the time. People that are adverse to it, it's like, oh boy, I don't know how you're going to keep up. And the people that are into it, they're just like blasting ahead. They've got program outlines, they've got ideas, they've got, you know, and I mean, AI is always wrong. You have to add yourself to it because it's never right. It just gives you a good starting point.
Yeah, it's like
engineering, that's a good skill.
It's the starting point, then you can go back and edit it, or you can, like what I normally do is I write something and then I get the AI to edit.
Yeah. Right.
That's make this more concise.
Yeah. I use it
and
as
it's
a...
like, oh, yeah, you don't need those 7 words and it's all good.
Right. I use it at the other end of it. I use it at the start where I'm trying to ideate something and I need a collaborator to kind of... I think of too many things and then I need a collaborator to hone it down and just... So I'll ask, an AI, how should I think about this? I have to do this thing. Here's some stakeholders. Here's my role. How might I think about this? And then I find it's more conversational. It just kind of helps me think, oh, right, I never thought about those things. Then all of a sudden now I've got a 5-point outline and now I've got confidence that, oh, those are good 5 points. It would have taken me an hour and a half to... Right. And I would have started on number 4 and then realized, oh, right, number 2. And it just accelerates all of that. But anyway, AI jockeys, man. what energizes you about that kind of work? Even though it was an emergent thing for you, you didn't realize you wanted to do it. But now that you're doing this thing that you do, how do you find energy in it? What is it about it that kind of gives you energy? Because that's the dream, right? I mean, not...
Yeah.
That it's a perfectly fully energizing job. I'm not saying that. It's just, what parts of it do you really enjoy?
I think for me, the piece that I've always found the most engaging is, I guess it's more like this, the experience of it, of like when I've done, like, we'll go to a store, like physically visit the store, sit with them, like watch exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
And like, that's engaging and, you know, exciting, energizing, just to sort of like watch what's happening. But then it's like the process that comes out of that of, oh, okay, now I've like, we as a group can have conversations, we can have like come up with ideas and and go and do a thing and see like, oh, we observed this thing, I watched, I paid attention to what this person was doing, and I had this idea, or, you know, we as a group had this idea of like how to address it. And and now it's a real thing. And like, now we can like, you know, release it and you can get like, you know, feedback from a bunch of different people. And I think it's really exciting, this idea of like, you can observe how people are doing a thing in the real world.
Yeah.
And then take some, you know, just ideation, brainstorming, you know, working through the problem with other people, and we can create something that actually addresses the problems that they have and makes their life a bit easier. And when we do that, it's like, it's very exciting.
I can't agree.
You know, in the early stage, like in some ways, like it was so much easier to do that because you don't have anything. So it's like, you're just like, you know, you go and like, we have a conversation with someone and like, then that you'd have like the next, like, 2 months of work to like go and build all this stuff, and you're just like, and now it's like, there's a lot more, like, I don't want to say compromises, but there's a lot more like, you're balancing between these different pieces. Well, there's this thing, there's this thing, and like, we're trying to figure out how this thing works, and like, what if, you know, so it's a lot, it's gotten a lot more complex over time. But yeah, that piece sort of at the core is like the exciting, energizing part of it.
I can't agree with you more. In my early days, you know, the wireless retail market at that time was really in, this is 2002 when we went to market and got our first clients in Vancouver. We got 6 clients. So we needed a client services manager. So that's how I came along. And so I started that client side of the business. But what was beautiful about it is that you'd go visit a client, just look at their problems they're trying to solve. And they were so abundant, right? Because we were hitting clients. Our sweet spot, frankly, was when clients were growing. And a person can run 3 stores in their mind. They can't run 7. Right. And so we ran into many, many, many clients where the founder was just at that point where they just couldn't scale their business in any way. We would go and offer them this business management software that automated some things, but still allowed them to have the specialness of being an entrepreneur in there. And we always wanted to preserve that because we knew that was big fuel for them.
Right.
But like you're saying, you talk to them, what's a problem you're having? How might we, And then to get at first principles thinking, how might we solve that? Because they always have a solution, but that solution, you know, doesn't, it there's doesn't always really a problem with the solution. So you have to get at the problem. But that was so beautiful. And then you built trust with them and they'd realize, oh, okay, I just have to get really good at describing the problem. And then Clayton will go back to Saskatchewan and they'll talk to the developers. Zenzer, of course, was one of them.
Yeah.
And then we would just iterate on that problem they're having. And then when you get to share it back to them, just the actual joy that they get. And it's all this green space. I'm talking about the very early days. It's all green space. They're just full of joy because, wow, right. I only have to carry one cell phone now. I only have to work 70 hours a week, or, you know, just all these things that these founders and then these store employees were just, man, just changing their day-to-day experience working in the store and being in that job was so energizing. I just loved it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny the thing you said, because we've been talking about AI a little bit as well, and like the thing that I hear a lot when people are talking about like building AI systems is that idea of like you always have to let the person still be in it. Right. You can't automate the thing completely so the person isn't there anymore. So it's interesting that idea of, you know, even with these earlier types of systems, you know, like that same concept still applies, right? Yeah. That like it's like we want to think about the idea of how do we automate things? How do we make things simpler for people? How do we remove complexity? How do we like take parts of their job away? But it's like it's all to serve the purpose of like that, like, the essence of the thing that you can do to contribute is like,
yes,
comes through instead of being like caught up with all the tedious work.
Yeah.
Get rid of the tedious stuff so people can do the hard stuff, the interesting stuff.
The human stuff.
Like, the human stuff. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's the great part when we can actually pull that off.
Yeah. But then as you're talking, as that evolves over the years, then you're kind of making choices between, you're trying to get to the more right decision, I find, is kind of what emerges as the work. It's like, you know, it's just not obvious anymore. Right and wrong just kind of doesn't exist. It's like, how do we get to be more right? And then that becomes the kind of the scale up skill over time. But anyway, when you talk to your clients, how do you know you're doing it? How do you know you're bringing joy to their lives?
I mean, I think you, I don't know, it's like you just kind of know. I don't know, that's a terrible answer.
Mm-hmm. You do though. You feel it. I agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, so there's all the metric-y parts of these things, but like that's not really how you know for a person that you've helped them.
No.
Right. That's how you know for the company, and that's how you know for
that's right,
the organization overall and all this stuff. But, you know, again, there's nothing that's quite the same as, you know, having a conversation with a person and seeing them, you know, work through things.
You still get on site quite a bit?
I don't as much as I used to. No. I did a little bit this year. I did earlier this year. I went to a couple stores in Vancouver, which was really fun. But in the early days, like I was going a lot. Like, you know, it's like you always sort of think back of like the first, like our very first customer, which was in Olympia, Washington. I went there like six times or something like that. Like over the course of like 3 months, maybe. Like we were down there so many times. I knew all the staff by name, you know, followed some of them on Instagram. We were just like part of the crew in a way. Right. Like we would go down there and we'd sort of see what's going on. And so each time, like you know, we would have fixed some of the things that they had brought up from last time, and there had been some issues that like we sorted through this and like we worked on this, and like you'd show them and they'd normally be pretty happy about like, okay, that's great. Like now we don't have to do this thing. Okay. This report gives us the information we need now, so we can, you know, pull it into this other thing. And now I can like do all this ordering stuff. It's like, you see the impact that it's having on people
yeah.
in the store. Again, over time, like that stuff's all abstracted away, right? You get emails from somebody that says, this was great. You get emails from someone that says, this is awful. Why did you do that?
Yeah.
You know, and they're about the same thing. And like, then you go, how did you do it? Right. So
you're transitioning from that. Yeah. From that early days, green space to, I remember that transition too. It's like, oh, wow. I'm in my office a lot. I'm not really traveling much anymore. And the conversations are different. You know, the scale of the problems is different. It's interesting. Yeah, I remember that transitioning time too.
Yeah, and it's interesting because like, and you know, before this we were sort of talking about the idea, like the sort of maybe like the tie-in with the pandemic stuff. Because honestly, like that really shifted it for us. Back when the pandemic started, we were still going on site to launch customers.
Right.
We would have. We were kind of, it's like we were trying to get out of it because it was pretty expensive and it was like a big, it took way longer.
Yeah. And,
it was
and like the clients really want you there though. They really
people
want
you
there.
Yes. And all that. So like
I remember that.
You know, we really were actively working to not do that.
Yep.
And it wasn't, I wasn't involved in that part anymore, but you know, as an organization, we were going on site to do all these launches, but I was still traveling a lot to, you know, go to different places, either our current customers or our potential customers.
I
remember we had this we were talking to this customer in Massachusetts and I was having a conversation with my boss about like, oh well, maybe I should go I'll go to Massachusetts, I'll spend a few days with this customer, like that would be great. And we're like, this is gonna be perfect, okay, like you're gonna do that. And then like I remember listening to podcast The Daily. Can we name drop other podcasts on this podcast? Sure. I don't know if that works.
We can name you on. Benny will just bleep it out if he doesn't like it.
Okay. I was listening to The Daily and it was like about COVID and it was about how like in Massachusetts, it was like awful.
No.
It was really bad there. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to have to tell Nicole I don't think I should go to Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And it was like that day that IQ announced that like we're canceling all work travel, like no one can travel. And I was like,
I don't
have to pull the plug on this. I can just let like that happen.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, like a couple of days later, it was like, we're all packing up and going home.
Yeah. For a few weeks.
For a few weeks, exactly. Like until the whole thing blows over.
It's been 5 years. I've been at home in my basement. Bonkers.
Yeah, it's so crazy. It was a big change.
Changed your business, hey?
So yeah, and I think it really changed how we operated. It changed how we operated again, like I was saying, with the like launching customers. So that had to shift completely. It shifted how we a bit of how we approached the problem solving aspect of it, because we had to like pull away from like going to places ever and like just like rely on, you know, talking over the phone, talking over Zoom and Teams and things like that. Like it also just, it changed like the how we work part, right?
Yeah.
Because we were used to working in person in the office. I think for our company, like, you know, both as Kova and as IQmetrics, a thing that always has been a really like a big strength of these organizations has been the culture and like the community and the people who work here and how we interact together and how we like interacting together.
So still there, but yeah, it's very different.
Yeah. Yeah. There's fewer opportunities to see it.
Yeah.
And to take advantage of it. That sounds like the wrong way of saying it. Like just
leverage it.
Occur. Yeah. Leverage it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds better.
I was watching this Netflix documentary called Join or Die. Have you seen this?
Is that the, Robert Putnam?
Exactly. So it's Robert Putnam.
I haven't watched it, but I know the thing, like Bowling Alone.
Yes. And so this is actually what was really poignant for me, really meaningful for me to read. And so Putnam is a researcher. He's done a lot of research that's fascinating. Just if the audience out there feels like getting a little bit nerdy about this, search for Putnam. He's got some wonderful research over the last few decades about this topic, community. And so he's been looking at, well, what happens? What are the structures that create community? And then how do those kind of, what's happened to them over the last 20 years? And so this documentary is an update with, you know, an older version of Putnam reflecting on this stuff just conversationally. So it's a lot more digestible than research. But basically the beautiful point of clarity was, he goes like, think of it this way. If you can get 100 people to go bowling, that's one thing. And it's not nothing. But if you can get 100 people to join the bowling league, those people will be energized because what they're doing has purpose. It's elevated purpose towards the community. And I was really floored by that. Because I was like, oh, that is it. It's so when you try to manufacture things, and we've done a lot of things in our company since the pandemic to try to get people to come together. And again, those aren't nothing.
Yeah.
But it's the purposefulness of it. Like, and it's like you in that green space of a new startup, going to meet a client, coming back, describing a problem to your colleagues, them getting energized about how to solve it. Like, you've got purpose. And it's not just being with other people. It's the purposeness of it.
Yeah. No, I think that that's very true. Yeah. And I mean, to sort of tie this back to this, like the startup thing, like I think like that is what's so energizing about it.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like we're all kind of in it together, right? We're all trying to sort out how to make this thing work, right? And like that creates a lot of shared sense of purpose, shared sense of, you know, if we don't, we just have to, like, you know, we got to sort it out. We can all have different opinions about what the right thing to do is, but like we can just, let's come up with something. You know, and like it's not just about doing something for the sake of doing it. We're doing it to sort of, I mean, help our customers, help ourselves, like, you know, advance this process.
Yeah, there's a reciprocity there. You make me think about the intimacy of a startup too. Those same problems happen in a bigger, more mature company, but the intimacy of them isn't there. You don't have 10, 20, 30 people gathering around. We used to ring the bell when we get a client, and the salesperson, everybody would, you know, you hear the bell and we'd come up from the second floor to the fifth and everybody would gather around and the salesperson would literally tell us the story of the client, who they are, where they live. It was just like,
how many kids they have?
Right.
Do they have a dog?
I can't tell you how many times I'd go visit a client and they'd take me to their cottage and we'd just sit and do that as if we were friends. It was so different. They'd take you to a play. They'd send you to the Yankees game. Just because they wanted you to be happy too, because the relationship was intimate. It was so different. Wild.
And then, and I mean, and I think the thing, like, you know, for both the IQ and COVID, I mean, like, it's like, then you are successful, which is what we want. Mm-hmm. And the result of that success is, in many ways, like, you get further and further away from these things, right? Like, you know, IQ, they don't announce every sale that they make anymore, right? Like, no. You know. And that's good. It's like, that's the system working. Like, that's what we want out of this, because at some point it's not special anymore because it's happened so many times. And like that's
part of the flywheel.
You know, that's great. Like, this, now we're just doing it. But, you know, there are things that you sort of miss of that stage because it feels very close. It feels very intimate, as you said, right? Of like, and you know, and as companies get bigger, like you lose a lot of those like special touches, and then it's all sort of like operationalized.
Operationalized is the right word. Yeah, that's exactly, and you have to, otherwise you can't scale.
I mean, you can't spend half a day, you know, celebrating every sale when you're sick.
You can't spend as much as I liked it. You can't spend 4 days in Jacksonville, Florida, helping a client
Right.
Get ready to go live. Right. It's totally unscalable. Right.
Think of the expense of it.
Just everything. The inefficiency, financial inefficiency, the time inefficiency.
Yeah.
You know, as you're growing and scaling as a company, you have to find these efficiencies.
Yeah.
I wonder how you, but then you have to find the joy still, right? You have to find whatever it is that got you into the startup. If you're going to stay with that company, you have to redefine a bit to yourself. Well, what makes me happy? What gives me energy? Or like early Dave, try 5 startups. Like you just kept doing startups, right? Just keep going. Right. So you kept doing that. Or if you're going to stay at a place, you have to change, you have to update your model of, well, what gives me energy and what gives me joy.
This is going to feel like a bit of an aside, but like I always think about the thing of people saying, like, if someone says they have like 10 years of experience, do they have 10 years of experience, or do they have like 1 year of experience repeated 10 times?
Right.
And
oh, that's pretty brilliant.
I think about in the context of this experience of today, actually, maybe this is like public. Today is my 9-year anniversary at Chrysalis.
What?
Yeah.
Today.
Today. Yeah.
That's interesting.
The day of this being recorded, not the day of this being released. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about 9 different things, but like, you know, what my job is here, what my like work to do has evolved so much in that time.
You've had a few careers, and like, essentially.
Probably. Right. It's like you're doing so many different things, and how you do it is different, and what exactly you're doing is different, and all those things. And like, I think that is very energizing. And that's like, as compared to, you know, there are people, and honestly, there's people at our company that have had the same job for the past, you know, 8 years, right? Like they're kind of just they're doing the same thing. And again, for some people, that's great because it's like now they're so good at that.
That's right.
And they love it. And like
need that
they
too.
Just get deeper and deeper and deeper into it.
Yeah.
But I think that, my personality is more of, you know, I like that I'm not doing the same thing I was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
Not doing the same thing that I was 6 years ago or even 2 years ago. It keeps on changing and iterating and evolving. And that's a great thing about, like, you know, being in this company is the company's growing and changing and evolving and shifting and all these things. And like, so like the opportunities are constantly shifting.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing about a startup. It's if you think about a career path in a startup, a way I would describe it is it's you're in an environment that is growing so fast that cracks appear, and those cracks you just like, oh boy, someone has to fix that. Well, that becomes a job. Like you do a few of those cracks, like emergent things, and all of a sudden, well, that's your job now, and you're starting an educational services department. Oh, okay. You're starting a training department for clients, you know, like. But that didn't exist 3 months ago.
Right.
And it just emerged as a thing that needed your attention. And then the scope and scale of it became more clear to you. And it's like, I guess this is my job now. So you go from running client services to professional services, because we're trying to, you know, figure out, okay, we've got all these clients and we've helped them get operationally clean. How do we get them to use our software even more effectively? So that emerges, right? And then, oh, our clients need more scalable training. So you start a training department. And then, oh, you know what? Internally, we need training. So you move to internal training, you know, coaching. I'm just describing different things that I've done. And the careers at the time are unclear, the career path. But in the rearview mirror, I find it's really interesting and dynamic. It's like, oh, wow, that was fascinating. So I'm 22 years in, I guess, 23 years. And it's fascinating to look in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
None of that stuff was in the windshield. None. It just was none of it.
Well, in the time when you started and when you joined this company and all that, so like the need for 90% of that didn't exist.
Oh, exactly.
Right? Like the need for one of those things existed, and it was the thing you were doing.
That's right.
And but but then, yeah, it's like everything, it gets so much more specific. It gets so much, and the scale of everything increases dramatically over time.
Yeah.
It has to.
Otherwise, you just can't. You just can't keep growing. You can't meet the needs. You have to operationalize because you have a new emergent problem in the business or in an opportunity out in the market. Like, and if you're not operationalizing, if you're not getting cleaner at your operations, you can't react to that stuff. And then you're off foot, you know, you're not ready. And even if you see it, it's like, oof, we can't do that.
Right.
And then you missed, and then a competitor's done it, and then things really start to
cascade in the other direction.
Yeah, it gets messy. And then you have to stop and take a big think and get back to first principles. Like, what are we doing? What are we doing? And you have to keep asking yourself that all through the years of, I noticed anyway, what's the problem we're solving here? Because like we said earlier, you're not choosing between right and wrong anymore. It's more right. How do we get more right?
Yeah. No, there's very few things that we get to make choices on that are between a good option and a bad option.
Almost never. Yeah. Very few. You're right.
Very few of them. And when they happen, I mean, like we've already decided and we didn't even realize we were doing it because it was so easy.
Yeah. That's right.
But the ones that are much harder and that we spend a lot more time discussing and working through is, there's two great things to be doing. And we have to do, we just don't have the capacity to do both of them. So we have to choose which of them we're doing. Yeah. And that, you know, that's very hard. And and it's easy to then go back and sort of be like, I wish we'd done this way. But like, you just never know. You never know what would have happened. And I just think about it's like where we're at now. It's like, okay, like, there are so many choices we could have made 6 years ago that would have meant that we weren't here now.
That's right.
But we don't know which choices those are.
You don't know which ones they are. Even in the rearview mirror, it's not clear.
Even in the, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's probably a number of really key things that we did that we didn't even realize were that big of a deal.
That's right.
Definitely, if we had done it differently, the company wouldn't exist now. Or the company would exist, but it'd be totally different and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we did something, right?
What do we need to learn, or what have you learned? And I'll share some things that I've learned about the transition that needs to happen in the mindset to move from a full-on startup mentality to something else. One of the things that I noticed got in the way was this no wrong decisions fallacy. When it's all green space, it actually feels like there's no wrong decisions to be made, because everywhere you turn, there's something relatively urgent. And so you just keep doing that. And that's the career path thing that we were just describing. However, at some point, you have to figure out, no, there are wrong decisions to be made. And again, they're not obvious. It's not clearly wrong. It's just less right. And you want to figure out how to make the more right decision. And that is a problem that a startup has to solve. And when you don't, it's got these painful kind of legacy things that just get baked into the mindset. And it's about thinking there's no wrong decisions, and there actually are, but they aren't clearly wrong. I know we've said this 10 times, and I'm sorry to the audience.
It's that funny thing of when does a company go from being a startup to being not a startup? That is a bit of a semantic conversation, and so it's kind of irrelevant. But I do feel like we, at the stage that we're at now, are in a bit of what you were just talking about, which is we're moving from the point where everywhere you look, there's just green fields.
Yep.
To there aren't anymore. You know, we're really talking about how we play in a space that already has stuff built up in it.
Yes.
And I think that I don't think I really have a good answer to that question. It's interesting. It's like interesting to think about of, yeah. You know, we probably need to shift some of our thinking around that.
Yeah.
I think we have.
I know you have. I can see it. I can see a real change over the last few years and how that is. But you're right. You're not. You're just saying, you know what? Like everything else in a startup, it's just happening. And so you're not stopping to recognize it because you're still in a rapidly dynamic business. So I get that. But I could tell you as a third part, like as an observer, I can see your company changing in the way it does that. I'm just telling you, it's important that it happens.
I think you're right. I think you're right for sure.
What's something along this line that you identify as important for transitioning from a startup to something else?
I think when companies stop being a startup, I don't know, maybe I'm just going to say this and I don't know if this is really true, but it's like when you've got nothing, to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And as you stop being a startup, like you have stuff to lose, right? Like you move from this stage of, well, we can do anything because no matter what we do, like, I mean, this is kind of the thing we're just talking about, but it's like,
oh man, you're so right.
If you have one customer and like you completely shift everything in the company to make that customer happy, then like you succeeded.
Yeah.
Whereas once you have more customers, you have more systems in place, you're supporting people in this place, and then there's people in this place and this place and this place, and they all are doing things slightly differently, you know, all of a sudden you have much more risk associated with losing what you have than not getting what you might get.
Yeah.
And I think that's the shift that occurs. And I don't know what the inflection point is around that.
But there like is an amoeba. Certainly... I'll tell you, it's like an amoeba. It always is changing. You can never quite get your arms around that, but you always have to be aware of that. And you're bringing up something that's really critical in the transition that I witnessed at Archimetrics. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I think that is very much something that we're at the stage of now is, you know, we're very aware of, you know, what we have with the customers that we have and wanting to make sure that we're protecting that base.
Yes.
In a way, right? Like, okay, leveraging what we do have, you know, and there's sort of this hedging of like, is it more important to like do the things for them or do the things
for these
groups we might support?
Mm.
And that's a really, like, it's a really challenging thing. Yeah. And like, it, historically, you know, I remember having these conversations 6 years ago, let's say. Yeah. I mean, I remember one conversation, it was probably like roughly 6 or 7 years ago of like, I mean, it's going to sound really callous and it doesn't, but maybe, I don't know. This is like we could lose all the customers we have now.
Yep.
Because the thing that we're doing is about the next customers.
Yeah.
And if we get the next customers and then we lose all these current customers, it's fine.
Right.
Right. Like we don't want to have 10 customers forever. We want to have 100 customers. So we're doing the thing for 100 customers, even if it costs us the 10. But now we can't do that math anymore.
Yeah. Right?
Now we have, we can't say, oh, we'll ignore our current customers because we'll come and get another pool that's larger than that. Because like there isn't a pool that's larger than that. So
that's right.
That pool is much more important. So we can't just trade off the current group for the future group.
I think a real opportunity that you're making me remember is helping clients transition through market aggregation. I can't think of the right word, but
consolidation,
because that is inevitable. And of course, it's actually going on always and it'll accelerate. And the more a startup can embed some degree of support for that, for their clients, that's an area of benefit. It's relationship, it's financial too, but relationship wise, it shows that you're thinking about the needs of your constituents. And that's something I remember just wash over us. But in retrospect, that's something I wish I would have noticed and built some structure around to, because it's inevitable. And
no, boy, we're dealing with that. Like we are already at the stage where we're seeing that.
And it'll accelerate yes. tenfold. tenfold. Yeah. One last thing, I guess, an example of a thing I noticed about our company that we transitioned was when we was around hero culture. When there was a point in our development as a company where we would celebrate the heroics, and that made sense. But then there was kind of this period of time where we realized, you know, we need to celebrate heroics, but also put up a red flag. We need to notice that heroics are red flags, and we need to look at what's so thank you. Wow. Amazing. Ooh, right. Thank you
right.
for sleeping on the couch for 2 days and making this thing happen. How can we make sure this never happens again? And that's a transition that that's a mindset shift. It's almost necessary though, too, because those heroes will burn themselves out. And if you can't respect the flag they're throwing up by being heroic, you're going to miss out on the opportunity to have that person's wonderful energy and dedication and dynamic ability to apply themselves to your problems, because they're going to leave or they're just right. going to shut down, right?
Well, but the funny thing about that that I noticed too is that actually, but in some cases, the heroes in that story don't want to be like they still like they haven't hit the burnout stage, so yes. they still love it.
100%.
Right? And 100%. You know, I agree with what you're saying. It's like you need to shift out, like, yeah, it's like everything should be a process, and therefore, like, it's not, oh, it relies on this person, you know, checking a Slack message at, you know, 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we got lucky that they were awake and, like, happened to see the Slack message and happened to do a thing.
Yes.
But, you know, but, like, that's not success.
2 a.m.
You know, that's a fluke.
Yeah.
And so we need to have a process, but, like, for the person who likes doing that, like, that yeah, can yeah. be a big source of, like, what they love about their job. And right. so, like, it's not as simple as, like, it doesn't necessarily feel to that person like you're supporting them,
that's
even
right.
though your motivation is kind of towards that, right? That, yeah. like, oh, yeah, well, we want to, like, divert this stuff away from you so you don't have to do this. But yeah. it's certainly, yeah, but, you know, but they might, they love getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and doing whatever. So, like, yeah. they're totally happy to do that, right? It's like,
yeah.
I want there to be something for me to do when I wake up, but, you know.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's that part can be really You're hard. Right. I'm like, you know, how do you sort of, like, balance that stuff? But I would agree with you. Like,
yeah.
you know, when you're a small company, each person is doing so much, and, like, the individual right. personalities of each person are so essential to make the company work.
Yeah.
To make the teams work. And then over time that becomes less true, right? Yeah. And it's like it's not really on any one individual person. It's on the company and the systems and the processes and all that, the yeah. culture that's been created. Yeah. And the people, it's like, it sounds kind of bad, but it's like the people become more replaceable, but, like,
yeah.
that's the point. Because yeah. like, you can't have a company of 1,000 employees that relies on the unique talents of those 1,000 people. Like, they're segmented into different roles. You know, it's not realistic to assume that, like, each of them is going to bring some special unique thing that only they yeah. can do that has to be done. Yeah. Or if you have 5 people, like, yeah, if, like, if one of them sure. left, like, it would be a crisis, right?
You have trouble.
So it's just really, yeah, it's a big sort of shift of, like,
yeah,
to what extent is it the people who are there, and to what extent is it the systems, the processes have been built up, and how do we
I want to say though, Dave, that replaceability as an asset, the goal of most people should be, like, how do I say this? Like the replaceability of that person means we get to aim them
at something else.
That is way more important. Like, right. this is what I think a lot of times People don't realize that, oh, if I can actually make myself replaceable, I can actually be aimed at at problems that are actually novel and maybe a little bit more interesting, maybe emergent, right? And people, I think, kind of trap themselves with, well, I don't want to be replaceable. No, but that's not a bad thing because you're in a company that's growing and you're growing in many ways. So one of the ways companies grow is the problem sets that their customers bring to them. So that replaceable person doesn't mean we should actually describe it as that role. That person in that role is more replaceable because we've made better processes. But that person who emerged from that role is an incredible asset. So their replaceability allows us to aim them at things that will probably rejuvenate them, give them energy. And I just believe this is totally true. And this is why one-on-ones, things like that, are so important. Like a lead has to be in touch with what the people around them are energized by so that you can not. Sometimes people think, well, good, I don't want to do this work that I don't like. No, that's not it. You have to, as a leader, you have to help them understand the value of that work they don't like. And the value of getting through it so they can get to other things. But this other work, the shit work maybe, that people mistakenly think is shit work, has to be rephrased or reframed. But anyways, when you talk about replaceability, that's the idea that comes to my mind. It's so important. I've always had this goal, make myself replaceable by having really wonderful people around me that can do the things that I do, and then I'm no longer unique and I can move to something else. And that's a powerful, powerful thing, a powerful mindset in a company that is where the opportunities are growing.
Yeah, and I mean, that goes back to the thing of like, don't do the same job over and over again,
Yeah,
right?
man.
Move out of the job that you have, let someone else do it, and then go on to the next one.
Yeah. Wow. I really appreciate this conversation.
It's fun.
I had such a really great time kind of listening to what you're saying and reflecting on memories of mine that are 15, 20 years old and really getting energized again about, yeah, that was extremely exciting. Anyway, thanks for digging all that up for me. I really appreciate
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks
it.
for that. I had fun doing this. I think it was great.
You
Thanks for
did?
talking on the podcast. It worked
Yeah,
out
man.
well.
Yeah, I agree. This was great. Well, thanks for the chat. It's really good to get to know Dave Emmett. As I said, I learned so much about Dave Emmett here, but it was really wonderful because we were able to just look at your experience in a startup and the effect it has had on you. And it's been a nice chat. So thanks a lot for your time.
You bet. Thanks, Glenn.
All right, we'll catch you later.
See ya.
And we're back. Clayton, I gotta say, that was not fully what I was expecting. Mostly because before we did this, a little insider baseball for everyone, we have production meetings. And Clayton asked what he should talk to Dave about, and for about 22 minutes, a TV half hour, I just said the nicest things possible about Dave Emmett. Just all the things. And I, talked about how much Dave loves running, his love of 90s and 2000s hip hop, how it really isn't a party if Dave isn't there. But amidst all that, you actually managed to dig past that and you found something even more interesting than that. You found something of great value and meaning, I think.
One of the things I really loved about this conversation was that we got at this idea of emergence, where there's just so much going on in a startup. It's very hectic, it's very intense, and it asks a lot of you. But Dave and I had a good chat about this, the effect of this emergence, and I used to kind of describe it as trying to hold on to a dragon's tail.
It was really funny for me because I edit this in the office, and Dave often comes to the office, and he saw I was working on the podcast that he's included in. And Dave asked, "Do you have any?" He asked me if he said anything funny, any bangers in there, and I didn't have that for him, which was surprising because usually I feel like I would be able to pull that out. What I did have was something that he said that really struck me, and I took it with me after and thought about it. And it was when Dave said he likes to think about when people, write down their experience at a company. And I think the line was something along, do you have 10 years experience or 1 year experience 10 times? And that really struck me as something of value. And, you know, then I proceeded to unpack that with Dave. And I don't know, it just kind of made me reflect on everything about working here. And that's the power of Dave. And I think that's also the power of Clayton, that you managed to get past all that surface stuff that I talked about earlier. And you really did unpack something with a lot of meaning to it. So, yeah, I really appreciated it.
Thanks, Betty.
Yeah. And if anyone listening appreciated it, you can reach out to us and let us know. Or if you know someone that would make a great guest like Dave to be on the podcast, well, guess what? You can go to the Chrysalis website. There's a form there under podcasts, and you can tippy-tap on your keyboard and send it off to us, and we'll get back to you, and, you know, we'll try to make it happen, because that's what we want to do. We just want to keep creating great experiences. I think I heard that somewhere. You know, all right. And with that, thank you so much for hanging out. Until next time.
See ya.
Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human.